Hello and welcome to Film Club. This is Jeff Yance. I'm the program director at the Loft Cinema, and I'm very happy to have here today occasional filmmaker Heather Lattis.
Hello.
And multimedia artist Rusty Boulay Stevenson.
That is the name I go by.
So this is going to be interesting. So today we're going to be talking about film lists, greatest films of all time lists. And what sort of sparked this idea was the fact that this is the 75th anniversary of Citizen Kane, typically considered one of, if not the best film of all time. So we're going to talk a little bit about how films get on that greatest films of all time list. What is the value of a greatest films of all time list? And how relevant are those lists? So we each went through what is generally considered to be the standard top 10 list for greatest films of all time, which is the Sight and Sound poll. It's a British magazine considered, I think, the best film publication in the English language.
Yeah.
And they come out with this list every 10 years. It's hundreds of international critics weigh in, pick the top 10 films of all time. The last list was from 2012. And the big news in 2012 was that the number one film of all time, Citizen Kane, was dethroned for the first time in decades.
Oh, my God.
I know. Seismic shift, dethroned by Vertigo, Hitchcock's Vertigo. And people were all aflutter about this. Aghast and aflutter. So we're gonna talk it out. And some of the other titles, I think, Rusty, do you have the list there?
Number one now is Vertigo. Number two
is Citizen Kane.
Yes. Number three is Tokyo Story. Number four is The Rules of the Game.
Yes.
And number five is Sunrise, a silent film.
Yes. And some of the other films are 8.5 and 2001 A Space Odyssey. So it's a pretty eclectic mix of American and non-American films. It's interesting, the top 10 list from the Sight and Sound list rarely changes. It's the same films in different orders.
The Searchers is in that list, I think, at number seven.
Right. Yeah. And all, I think, you know, worthy and great films in their own respect. But we do take umbrage at some of the choices, as most people do.
Well, and I think part of the reason that we should talk about is the fact that the way they come up with this list is they have critics fill out a list of their 10 films that they think are the greatest. And so, and every film is given the same weight. There's no, it's not a weighted system. And so part of why I think that, I think we all agree that that top 10 that is the Sight and Sound list is not our favorite 10 movies of all time, or not what we
Correct.
Would even call the top 10, the three of us.
Right.
Right.
And so the way they come about it is a little bit weird. Whenever I see polls like that, like if you don't weigh everything and you have people pick the 15 best albums of the 80s, always Joshua Tree by U2 comes up at the top, even though I don't know that those people would necessarily say that Joshua Tree is the best album of the 80s.
Right.
But because everybody agrees it's probably one of the top 15 albums,
it ends up on the list.
And so I think that's how we get Vertigo, and I think that's how we get Citizen Kane, even though they're obviously both great films.
Right.
And I just want to give a shout out too a little bit, because I've been listening to the podcast FlixWise, where they are looking at every single film on the top 100 list. They're counting them down or they're going down the list and looking at them. And so that got me thinking about the list as well. And then Jeff, you brought up the fact that you thought it would make for an interesting topic talking about this top 10 list. And so we all picked out one. And I think it's important to have a list like this that critics look at influential films. But if you look at the IMDb list of the top 10 films compared to the Sight and Sound critic list, it's a very different list.
Oh, yes.
Much more modern, obviously.
Number one, Shawshank Redemption on IMDb. Much different than Citizen Kane or Vertigo. But I think that also brings up an interesting point about the changing role of film critics in society. I mean, you know, the democratization of criticism that's come with the internet, everyone's a critic. There was a time when you had your Roger Eberts, your Pauline Kaels, your John Simons. Those were professional critics who had been trained to do that, had gone to school to be film critics, film history. So it's a little different now, and those kind of lists, I think the new lists tend to veer more towards more popular choices. Maybe there's fewer foreign films on those lists. It's just, it's a different kind of ranking system.
Yeah, well, it's more wide open. Anyone can vote on the IMDb. You know, it's held to a different standard, not as strict, not as, and we were talking about how Sight and Sound is more of a, how can you get to the foundation of filmmaking? Where do genres start? Where do types of cinematography start? Types of storytelling? And they all kind of come from that list of Sight and Sound, pioneering movies.
Yeah. And that's why it's such an important list. If you're going to be a real film buff, those are the movies that started a lot of those innovations. And I think that's what they're looking for. Innovation, films that did it first. So it's always going to be older films then, because pretty much everything has been done at this point.
Yeah, it's, you know, I just looked really quick, what are the modern movies that were on that list? And it was Mulholland Drive, In the Mood for Love, and Close Up were the only post-1970s movies. And if you look at all of those are all those three are pretty groundbreaking, story-wise, presentation-wise. Right. So I think that's kind of how it fits in.
Right. And I think, you know, we were mentioning this earlier, I think a film like Pulp Fiction probably will or should be on a list like that, because that was from the 90s, but its influence was enormous. And it did a lot of things first and affected a lot of change in cinema.
Well, and I imagine it will be remembered. People will still be watching and talking about Pulp Fiction 50 years from now.
Yes.
Right? And it will be. I mean, it's Quentin Tarantino's masterpiece. I think it's easy for me to say that. I don't know that you both agree, but to me, it's his best film. It's his most groundbreaking. The use of changing up time and the breaking of the three-act movie. He totally breaks it and reinvents it.
Oh, yeah.
And so in that way, it is. It's a completely groundbreaking film. You know, as far as that goes, like I mentioned to you off mic, Jeff, I think Toy Story, the first Toy Story movie, was the first computer animated film. Ultimately, that's probably going to be considered a very groundbreaking film.
Yes.
And it's still brilliant storytelling, too, by the way.
Well, I think it takes a long time for films to get into the canon. The canon is very institutionalized, and it can take decades to change. But we all wanted to look at one of the films in the top 10 list from Sight and Sound, and just to kind of talk a little bit about how relevant are those choices today. So, let's start with Heather. So, Heather, what film did you pick from the top 10 list?
Oh, well, you know, I wanted to pick a film that was a little bit lighthearted, which is funny because it presents itself as, but I picked 8.5 by Fellini. It's from 1963. Oh. And I think one of the reasons why it's in that list is because it kind of sets the format for the movie within the movie idea. So it's about a director directing a movie. It's played by Marcello Mastroianni, and he's supposed to be making this movie, but he's struggling. He can't find his story. He can't find the right actors. And this is kind of his struggle. And it's also involving his love life. It switches. So it's a movie within a movie, but then it also has this dreamlike sequences throughout, because he's reflecting on his history, where he come from, and where women have been in his life, all the way from when he was a child, relating to his mother, to being a youngster, and then his current marriage. And they're all very dreamlike sequences. And I think this movie sets itself apart and is the beginner. So beginner to movies like Birdman, where he has like this very, he's older too. And so the director in 8.5 plays Marcello Mastroianni, plays Guido Anselmi, and he's an older man who is late in his career trying to figure out what he wants, and Birdman is very similar to that, and there's a lot of shots that are like dreamlike, so there's some of that. And I didn't know until I was watching it that, you know, a couple scenes from Pulp Fiction are very directly, the dancing scene with Uma Thurman and John Travolta is taken from 8.5. Yeah. And it didn't, I mean, maybe someone mentioned it a long time ago, but it didn't dawn on me until I was watching it. And so I think that's why 8.5 is so important. It's a great story, and it's told in such a fresh new way, I'm sure, at the time. You know, some of the reviews from 1963 were just talking about how, you might have a hard time following, you know, because it was jumping back and forth in time.
Right.
And when he did jump back in time, it's a very fantastic kind of thing. It's very, a lot of Michel Gondry movies are kind of like this. And so it's 8.5 is a great film. I see why it's on the list. And they're also the underlying tortured love story of a man who doesn't really know how to love, but he's been in relationships, and that's kind of the underlying theme.
And so, it's very autobiographical of Fellini, which I think that was sort of groundbreaking at the time that a filmmaker was so nakedly revealing himself in a film through a fictional character.
Yeah, the 8.5 is because Fellini, this was his 8.5 movie. And even the mistress, who is played by Sandra Milo, she plays Carla, his mistress, was Fellini's mistress in real life. And so there's that, his little, you know, sliding that more real life stuff in there. And there's him dealing with his financiers. And, you know, I think he wanted to slide some of that real movie making in there that I don't think you saw in movies before this time. That kind of back, you know, they show a big spaceship being built on set for this movie that he's making. And I don't think they presented movies like that up until this point, not really like that.
Yeah. And so, I think there was mystery around the making of movies back then. Like, people didn't really know what went into the making of films and how difficult it could be for a filmmaker. So that it was pretty like raw, I think.
When in the idea of the auteur, like, I think they had talked about that, and that was, you know, not uncommon, but you see it. He's tortured. This is his movie. Mm-hmm. This is his love. You know, in a way, you could say, like, him making this movie is one of his loves. And, you know, as long with all of the many women that he has
in this movie.
It's, you know, and on that note, there is definitely some womanizing misogyny in the movie. I think I was able to see it and kind of let it go in terms of, like, just appreciate the movie for what it was in history and that kind of thing.
Well, and I think you have to do that with all of the top 10. 8.5 comes in at number 10, or maybe not all of them. The Searchers is number 7. I watched Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, which is number 5, a silent film. Mm. And that movie it treats all the women as objects. I went in expecting not to like it, though, but it is a profound film in the way that it's made. You have a moving camera for the very first time. It's the first movie that had a soundtrack. There's a lot about it that was really great. But if I look at it now through a modern eye, I'm really offended in part by the actions of the women, by the actions of the man, and the way he treats the women. It's a really frustrating thing to watch. And then I also watched Vertigo, which is the number 1 film. I thought it was really important to watch Vertigo and for us to talk about it since it is number 1. It's made by Alfred Hitchcock, of course. It's a good movie. I watched it, and the first 2/3 of it are so slow that I was wondering, why is this number 1? And then you get to the final third of the film, and there's a lot of stuff that is really interesting to a modern audience. Jeff, you showed it. You had a group of high school students come in and look at it at the Loft.
Yes.
And they found that pretty fascinating, that part.
They did. Once it starts getting into the weird territory with the identity swapping, I think they really latched on to that. That was a really kind of provocative modern concept for them.
And I think that that's really important as to why Vertigo has steadily, once it appears on the list for the first time, I think, in 1982 at number 7. And in 2002, it had gotten up to number 2 film. But I think that it's really appealing to a modern audience, maybe more so than Citizen Kane. I still don't consider it, I don't think, Hitchcock's best film.
And neither do I.
It's a little sloppy as Hitchcock goes.
We all agree.
We all agree. We don't think it's Hitchcock's best film.
Right.
But I can understand how there's a lot. For instance, the opening sequence was made by a man named Saul Bass, who made opening sequences for a lot of really great films.
Amazing.
And up through the 90s, he was still making opening sequences. But that is the first time computer-generated art was in a movie. Was in the movie Vertigo, that opening sequence
credits, of the swirling
images. Yeah, with the swirling images.
Yeah.
And so that's groundbreaking in and of itself, too,
right,
that it's doing that. There are things about it that I see why it's such a groundbreaking film. It also had the tracking in and zooming out, the trombone shot, they now call it, to simulate the vertigo. And that's a really groundbreaking thing that, and that kind of tracking shot would be used a lot later throughout film now. And so I get it, but I also think that there are parts of it that are really not Hitchcock's strongest filmmaking. It doesn't seem as precise as Psycho does. Psycho seems like everything is absolutely, every detail is absolutely plotted by Hitchcock, where I feel like in times with Vertigo that there's a looseness about it compared to some of his other work.
Yeah, and it's the messiness of Vertigo that a lot of critics have pointed to as being kind of indicative of this being like ripped from his psyche. And so it's revealing of the filmmaker in a way that maybe some of his other films weren't, because he wasn't so interested in the craft, because he was actually unleashing his inner turmoil.
That's an interesting...
Which you can feel in the movie.
You do.
It feels very personal and weird, and we know that Hitchcock was kind of a strange guy.
Definitely.
You know, his views on women and the blondes.
And there's a lot in that film. I mean, there's a scene where Jimmy Stewart pulls Kim Novak out of the water, and like that really, when I saw that, I'm like, oh my gosh.
What are you doing?
What? Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, I know it's intentional. You're supposed to think it's creepy, but it's so creepy to a modern audience that it's almost a little off-putting.
Well, and I think also the film, I think one reason people appreciate it is because it's been so influential. We were talking a little bit about the career of David Lynch, about how Vertigo has infected, I think, all of Lynch's work. You see it referenced time and time again, and a lot of other filmmakers have really pulled from it. So if that's one of the criteria for getting on the list, the influential part of it, it definitely qualifies.
It absolutely does. You can see it in the work of David Lynch and in so much of Hollywood, in fact, afterwards. I mean, just storytelling in general. I think that just the way it was made, I think it is incredibly influential today.
Yeah. And you can see why critics maybe at the time were a little taken aback by it, because it is a very modern sensibility in terms of how kind of icky it is.
Yeah. In fact, there was an alternate ending that was made because the film censor, the board at the time, was like, you can't let the guy who murdered his wife get away. You have to show that he's going to get caught.
Punishment. Yeah, exactly.
There has to be punishment. Right. Like, that was a big deal.
Sure.
At the time for movies and the way they're made. So it does speak to a more modern audience in that way. Again, I don't think it's his best. Is it better than Citizen Kane? Is it better than Tokyo Story?
No.
I tend to think not as well.
Yeah, I would say probably not. But as you mentioned, Rusty, it's interesting with these films, we have to look at them from a modern perspective, and a lot of the ideologies in the films now feel a little uncomfortable, and particularly The Searchers, which is on the list.
I hate The Searchers.
Yeah. Yeah. Yet massively, wildly influential, Star Wars, you know, et cetera. I mean, everything pulls from that movie in terms of the story. But the racial politics are kind of hideous.
Very hard for me to watch.
And yet it still lands at, you know, number seven. The greatest films of all time list. So the critics are looking at something else other than the ideology.
Though, as I pointed out, Birth of a Nation is nowhere to be found on this list, and it was incredibly influential as films go. But we've decided that movie, we can't laud it. We can't give it accolades really anymore.
Right.
Because of the just overt racism.
It's too heinous. Exactly.
It's very heinous. Yeah. It's a heinous film.
Right.
Though it was incredibly influential, I wonder if 50 years from now, if some of these films, like we talked about, maybe there will be more female directors and we're going to start moving away from these films. I think The Searchers, 50 years from now, The Searchers might be considered too racist. I would hope.
If you think about it, am I wrong? Is the only Western on that list? So, or is something else there? I think it's the only Western.
It's the only one.
So I think that part of it is them fulfilling that. That, I mean, Westerns have been hugely influential, even though they're my least favorite genre in cinema, you know. So I think, I don't know, I'm curious if they thought, oh, we need to have one. Mm. And I get it. Like, you know, I watched that in film class. I know about the Doré motifs.
The Doré motifs,
and all of that. And so I get it. But hopefully, like Rusty said, we'll evolve past that. And maybe we could have more I mean, I don't like the Western genre, so you're not going to get me in that on that list to say we have to have a Western. But I get why, because they think it's, you know, Star Wars, all of these movies have been influenced by the Western idea. And so I get why it's on the list.
Well, and so that brings us, I think, to your film that you covered, that you watched for this, is Citizen Kane.
Yes. Citizen Kane. Which is a movie I really love.
Yeah, I think we all three love this film.
Yes. Yeah, and I think we were also talking off mic about this, about how I think there's a certain reputation with Citizen Kane that because it's considered the greatest film of all time, even though it's not at the top of this particular list now, it's usually referred to as the greatest film. And I think a lot of modern viewers disregard the film because of that. I don't need to watch that because everyone's already decided it's the best film. I've heard about it. I've read about it. I don't need to actually watch it. I'm always surprised how many people who are film buffs said, I've never watched Citizen Kane. It's a shocker.
Shocking.
Yes. I would be shocked as well.
To me, it's a shocker. But to them, they feel like they've already seen it. They feel like it's played out. But if you actually watch Citizen Kane, it's amazing. It's entertaining. It's innovative. It's stylish. A great performance by Orson Welles as Charles Foster Kane. And I think the reason this movie lands at the top or near the top of every list is because it changed the language of cinema. I mean, before this, films were not nearly as complicated as Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
Very complex narrative structure, flashbacks, flash forwards, which I think at the time were a little confusing to people. Multiple narrators telling the story of this one character, trying to find the truth of this character through different perspectives, which later kind of Rashomon, the film, sort of picked up on that idea. And if you've been to film school, you know all the deep focus, of course.
Yes,
deep
you
focus.
Do.
Amazing Greg Tolan, the cinematographer, helped create this technique of the deep focus, which has now been absorbed into filmmaking, so it doesn't seem radical. But in 1941, it was virtually impossible to even physically do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the little tidbit about Citizen Kane I love is the use of the ceilings on the sets. That became a big deal that Orson Welles demanded that they have ceilings on the sets. Because movies at that point did not do that. They put lights and cameras up in the ceiling. But he thought it looked unrealistic.
Mm.
So in Citizen Kane, they have upward-looking shots so you can actually see the ceiling, which gives it this kind of claustrophobic feeling.
A lot of low-angle.
A lot of low-angle shots, which was radical at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Although, again, time has blunted a lot of the radicalness of it. But I think also you can't separate Citizen Kane from the persona of Orson Welles. And he's continually fascinating, still fascinating today, just looking at his career. This was a film he made when he was 26 years old.
It's hard to believe,
which is
isn't
amazing.
It?
Yeah.
His first film, of course, he was, he did stage productions and the radio productions were the world.
Groundbreaking radio and stage productions.
He had a huge career before he was a filmmaker.
Before he was 26.
Yeah. And I think the fact that he was 26 and knocked it out of the park, made the greatest film of all time, I think that cheeses people off a little
making
bit.
Making us all feel bad about ourselves.
Yeah, like slackers.
Yeah, I'm feeling lazy right now.
Yeah, but he himself, I think, was never able to live up to that. I think he spent his whole career trying to live up to the reputation of Citizen Kane, and I think it drove him a little nutty.
He peaked. And
yeah, that's really tough. I mean, even though we've talked about, we don't necessarily think this is our favorite Orson Welles film.
No, it's not. It's not my favorite.
It's not. Orson I would Welles. Go with Touch of Evil, personally.
I'm absolutely in agreement.
Yeah.
I also love F for Fake. It's not a great film per se. It's a little too disjointed to be. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot about it that I think really influences modern audiences. F for Fake is going to get a better and better reputation over the years, I still think.
Yes. And I think, Orson Welles, a lot of his problem is that the studios meddled in all of his films after Citizen Kane. It was the one film he had total control over, and this Hollywood said, no more. Because he kind of went for broke on Citizen Kane and did everything in that film.
Mm-hmm.
It was a flop. You know, audiences were a little baffled by it. It was a little too complex. But critics started picking up on it pretty quickly as a great film.
Well, yeah, Orson Welles never made movies that made a ton of money.
No.
But he was loved. He was beloved by other directors and by people who made films, people who worked on films.
Yeah.
Maybe not if you worked with him. He was kind of exacting.
Yes.
But,
yeah.
But he was very much appreciated immediately. Once Citizen Kane is made, real critics and real filmmakers knew he had done groundbreaking work with that.
Right.
That's not the case with Vertigo. Vertigo just broke even. Didn't lose money, but broke even. But it was, there were some people who said this might be his masterpiece, Hitchcock's masterpiece. But most, by and large, that wasn't the case. It was just considered a good movie.
Right.
And in fact, there were a lot of flaws with it. James Stewart's age, he's 49. Kim Novak, I think, is 24 at the time.
A little creepy. Not commented on in the film.
No, not at all. And in fact, I forget her name, who plays Midge.
Oh, Barbara Belgettis.
That's right. But she's 34 and he's 49, and they supposedly are the same age in the film, and that really caught me. That was when she said, "Oh, remember when we were in college?" I'm like, "No way, nope, I don't remember that, and neither does he."
And that's the Hollywood star system at work, because Jimmy Stewart was a big star.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you cast him in the film even though he was too old for the role. Although, supposedly, Hitchcock thought he was too old as well.
Yeah. Afterwards, he certainly says that he felt like that was a big part of the reason the movie didn't make that much money.
Right. Right.
He wasn't a heartthrob anymore? Yeah. Or was he?
Supposedly not, according to Hitchcock.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call him a heartthrob then.
Yeah.
But he was beloved. And that's the thing that's kind of is interesting about Vertigo is he's such a creepy guy in Vertigo.
That's true.
That he was beloved before that. He's in Harvey, and he's in, you know, stuff that Mr. Smith goes to Washington.
Yeah. Everybody loves Jimmy Stewart.
Right. And here he's a creep.
He's a creep. Yeah. Yes. Which was kind of radical against typecasting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I want to add that back to why I think Citizen Kane should be before Vertigo is that if you look, even if you take away the storytelling, if you just look at the shot comps and the cinematography and the camera work of Citizen Kane and you put it up against Vertigo, it's no competition.
No.
And if you just take that and put it up against any movie today that makes $50 million at the box office, Citizen Kane will blow them away any day of the week, in my opinion, just because of the creativity of the shots and the cinematography. So I still think it's earned its place. It still should be at number one, or at least above Vertigo. So that's just my little techie
I think
thing.
So too. And I think the reason it got knocked down is, I think, because of that issue of people being tired of it being the greatest film of all time. There's fatigue. Citizen Kane fatigue.
There is. Well, and as I mentioned, I listened to the FlixWise podcast, and they've had a couple of the voters on. And one voter said specifically that he wasn't going to vote for Citizen Kane. He decided he was going to pick his 10 favorite directors and pick what he considered their best films. And so that's how he made the list. And that's why these lists are so... It's ridiculous anyway to compare Vertigo to Sunrise to 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Right.
Like, that's a ridiculous... you can't do it, really.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
I mean, even Tokyo Story is one of the most beautiful movies I've ever seen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ridiculous that it's below Vertigo. But hey.
Yeah. But definitely Citizen Kane, I think we all agree, belongs up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly top three. It's hard for me to not call it the best film. Again, it's just like with the Coen brothers. I think the Coen brothers' No Country for Old Men is probably their great masterpiece. It is not my favorite Coen brothers film to watch. I will watch Oh Brother, Where Art Thou over and over and over again before I ever pick up No Country for Old Men again. It's hard to watch. But it's a masterpiece.
Yeah. Mm. And I think with the three films we chose, 8.5 and Vertigo and Citizen Kane, you also have to look at the reputation of the directors, because all these three directors, you know, Fellini, Hitchcock, and Orson Welles, larger than life characters that people know even if they haven't seen their films. And their whole body of work, I think, influences how they get selected and put on these lists.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, because I don't think any three of those directors, you would say they don't have some of the greatest bodies of work in the history of cinema.
Agreed.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Well, and as far as that goes, like I keep going back to Sunrise because I watched it for this, and it's F.W. Murnau. He also was a profound director. Nosferatu he directed, and a few others that are considered classics. And I think that you're right. And I think if you look at any of these top 10 films, you've got Kubrick in the top 10.
John Ford,
you know. So yeah, I think that that has to play into, that's where you're like, okay, these are the 10 best directors, and I'm going to pick their films.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Right,
and I totally get that. So why isn't Taxi Driver on the list?
It's not one of Scorsese's best. Gasp.
Oh.
Now we're fighting. Heather and I are now going to duke it out.
No. Yeah. That's hard for me to watch. That's all.
Well, it's also 70s, and none of the 70s films really hit the top 10. Which
no, that's right.
Right.
Oh, also, Man with a Movie Camera is in there, and that's a yes. Russian film, right? That
yes.
comes in at number 8.
Yep.
And that was... I've watched it. It's a really great documentary. It feels like somebody who's got a new toy, and that's what it is they're like trying out all these new things. What right. can I do with this camera that's taking images, and I can run them together and make it look like things are moving? And it's a profound movie. Do I think it's really one of the top 10 films? If I were going to an island and I was going right. to be stuck on an island and I could only take 10 movies with me, I'm not taking Man with a Movie Camera. And I love documentaries. That's probably my favorite genre.
But the desert island argument is interesting because I would probably take Ferris Bueller's Day Off with me, but I would never claim that's one of the best films ever made.
That's right.
So best and
yeah.
favorite are certainly
different. Yeah.
Very, very different. So I think that's what professional critics... So this whole idea of professional critics sort of giving way to everyone being a critic, I think it has good and bad points. I think professional critics can look at things apart from whether they personally love the film. And I think it's harder if you're just a movie fan to separate in
yeah,
that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
that's how Shawshank Redemption ends up number
exactly.
one on IMDb.
Right.
These are people still very interested in film. They're looking stuff up on IMDb. They're learning about movies more. They're learning about the cast and maybe the trivia. But yeah, Shawshank Redemption is not a great film, in my opinion.
No. And
I think it's a good film.
It's good storytelling.
Yeah.
It's
and
good.
We risk the wrath of IMDb users everywhere by saying that, but I don't think it's a great film.
Right.
No.
It's entertaining. It's good.
It's good acting.
Yeah. But you never call it the greatest film of all time. Maybe people's favorite film.
Right.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Big difference.
There is a big difference right. there. Yeah, very few of these films, none of the top 10. 2001 A Space Odyssey, if I was on the desert island with a large screen, and, you know, I wouldn't want to watch it on a TV.
And then a 70-millimeter projector.
For the rest of my life.
Yes.
But, yeah, if I have a 70-millimeter projector on
yes.
my island,
right.
then absolutely I'm taking 2001 with me, because that's going to be endlessly entertaining.
Not yes. me.
I could watch it.
Not to Heather, yeah.
Or my wife.
All right, well... The debate rages on, but it's always fun to look at top 10 lists because you always want to argue with them.
Yeah, it makes for good fodder to talk about.
Yeah, that's what loving movies is all about, fighting about them. So we're getting ready to wrap up here, but I wanted to thank, of course, Heather and Rusty for being here. And
sure, thanks, Jeff.
Yeah,
thank you.
Offering
all that great insight. Yeah. So we're going to be looking next week at another interesting topic because of where we are here in Tucson, Arizona. We're going to be looking at films shot in Tucson and what that means.
Yeehaw!
Yeehaw! It's not just for Westerns anymore.
And cactus.
Which brings us to rule number 888 of Film Club. There's great filmmaking going on in your backyard. Just open the door.
That's true.
Yes. So we're going to talk about some of those great films next week at Film Club.
And Heather and I are going to fight right now.
Okay, good. Go for it.
No.
Thanks for listening.